sense. So let's continue from yesterday. So I want to continue about this idea of how to overcome defilements and how to overcome obstacles in the mind. And then once I've done this last sutta, we can go back to where we left off before in the gradual training. Okay, so this is what it says. Monks, there are these five themes that should often be reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder or one gone forth. What five? A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth should often reflect thus. I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth should often reflect thus. I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. A woman or a man, a householder or one going forth should often reflect thus. I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth should often reflect thus. I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth should often reflect thus. I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resort. I will be the heir for whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. Okay, so this, I hope you can remember at the very beginning here, I was talking about the eight precepts and how the eight precepts work. And the fifth one of those eight is the one about not drinking. And I said, of course, that this is about being clear, being sober, and not being intoxicated. So you have the clarity of mind. But it's not just drugs and alcohol that cloud your mind. It's also how you look at the world. If you look at in the world in the wrong way, it's like you get intoxicated by, in this case, by feeling young, feeling alive, all of these things. If you look at them in the wrong way, it's the same kind of intoxication that you can have with alcohol or drugs. So the purpose of these reflections here is basically to clear the mind, of any sense of being like intoxicated. Intoxicated means that you cannot see clearly, basically. So the interesting thing here is one of the rare suttas what the Buddha specifically mentions. He mentions a woman and a man, and he also mentions a householder and one somebody gone forth. So what this indicates is that this is a very kind of foundational thing here. When he specifically mentions it applies to everybody, it means it's a very kind of foundational thing in the spiritual life to reflect in this way here. Okay, so let's have a look at these things. So this is the first one here. For the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man or a householder or one gone forth often reflect thus? I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. In their youth, beings are intoxicated with their youth. And when they are intoxicated with their youth, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with youth is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth often should reflect in this way. I'm subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. One of the problems when you are young is that you tend to feel, you don't think it maybe, but you feel as if this is going to go on forever. It's very difficult for a young person to think of themselves as old, or to understand that old age is also part of them in a sense. But the reality, of course, and everybody understands this, if you think about it, it's very obvious. But the reality is that if there is youth, you must be old age, because the idea of youth only makes sense in contrast to old age. So wherever there is youth, you must also be old age. So if you can say that the reality of this body, or the reality of existence, is that old age is already here. It's already within you. It's just waiting to ripen. But it's actually already there. It's just as much part of you, old age, as youth is part of you. So you can, in a sense, you can say that you're already, in one way, you're already old, because one day it must happen. In one way, you're already young. These things are always part of us at the same time. So think about yourself. What is it like to be old when you get old? What does that feel like? And when you are really old, you know, things start to fall apart, right? You can't really see, your eyes start not to work anymore, your hearing doesn't work very well, your legs start to get wobbly, you can't walk properly, you have to walk with a stick, you start to get crooked and bent over. And basically, the body starts to fall apart. And it's not a very nice thing when this happens. So when you see an old person, you can reflect, well, this is me, I'm like that, I have the same nature. And what that does, it takes away the sense of disgust at old age, or disgust at, you know, sometimes when you see old age, you feel slightly repelled by it. But there's no need to be repelled by these things. This is just the way things are. And when you look at it that way, it takes away the sense of pride, the sense of intoxication. I am young. I am different. And you realize, actually, there isn't really any difference there. And this creates kind of like a balance in the mind. The mind becomes more balanced. It doesn't become so one-sided. The idea is not that you should go and, you know, go to the other extreme and kind of think of yourself as an old person or whatever. The idea is just to balance things out so they become more neutral. And when things are more neutral, you don't go to excesses, you don't do stupid things because of that kind of wrong impression you have. It gives you a sense of gratitude, right? You think, okay, I'm still strong, my body is still good. So give a sense of gratitude that you still have that sufficient youth in you to be able to do what you want to do. So you are grateful for this opportunity. And it also reminds you that old age, often it comes very fast. And because it comes very fast, you know that now is the opportunity. I must take the opportunity while I still have it. Life is very short, right? It passes very fast. When I think about myself, it seems like yesterday I was only 20. It's actually quite a long time ago now. And this is the way life is. It goes very fast. Sometimes it's good to speak to people who are older, and they will tell you how fast it goes. And there is a nice sutta. It was one of my favorite suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. And this sutta, it talks about a long time ago. There was this spiritual practitioner, and he had some very high samadhi attainments. And his teaching to his disciples were, life is short and full of suffering. So life is short and full of suffering. And then the sutta continues and says, but in those days, lifespan was 60,000 years, and there was only three kinds of illness: hunger, cold, I think, hunger, thirst, cold and heat, and having to go to the toilet. Those are the only illnesses people had. So 60,000 years, right? Life is short. So that puts things in perspective. But it's probably true, though. You know, even 60,000 years, it probably goes actually very fast. And of course, now, these days, if you become 100 years old, that's considered a very old age. So again, it goes very, very fast. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. So this is about illness. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus? I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. In a state of health, beings are intoxicated with the health. And when they are intoxicated with the health, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. For when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with health is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to illness, I am not exempt from illness. So again, you have this idea that health and illness, they are just opposite sides of the same coin, right? So if there is such a thing as health, there must also be such a thing as illness. So one thing implies the other. So if you are healthy, you know that the illness is just behind the surface. It reminds me of the story which Adam Brahm, my teacher in Australia, he always says that when you go to the doctor, you shouldn't go to the doctor and say, something is wrong with me. You should say, something is right with me. I'm sick today. And when you think like that, you think that, wow, how wonderful it is, I'm healthy. You just don't know when things are going to turn around, right? Sometimes as a monk, one of the nice things about being a monk is that often you go to the hospital, you go to, you know, people die or people are sick. And you see that people of any age, any time, can get very, very serious illnesses. So then you have a sense of gratitude, right? Wow, wonderful, I'm healthy. Who knows how long it's going to last? This is my opportunity. This is my chance. Time is short. You never know if the opportunity comes back. Now I have the opportunity. Now is the time to do what is good, to do what is right. Okay, next one. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus? I'm subject to death. I'm not exempt from death. During their lives, beings are intoxicated with life. And when they are intoxicated with life, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with life is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to death, I am not exempt from death. And this one is probably the most powerful one. This is more powerful than reflecting on old age, more powerful than reflecting on illness. Why? Because death is more complete, more final, more absolute, and you can be absolutely sure that you're going to die. So, and the thing about death is also, it is a reflection that the Buddha talks about a lot in the suttas. You see it again and again. So it's actually a very important part of the teachings of the Buddha. So because of that, because it is an important part in the teachings, it is actually something that obviously the Buddha singles out as having a particular value. And it's very powerful when you think about death, when you know you're going to die. And the point here is you have to make it real, right? It can't just be kind of, I'm going to die in some kind of light fashion. It has to be real. And remember that you don't know when it's going to be here. Death is very unpredictable. It comes when you don't expect it. It comes to young people. It comes to old people. You don't know when it's going to be here. And unless, if you are not prepared to die today, then when the day comes, you are going to die. Then also, you will not be prepared. So there is a very powerful thing here. If you're going to die, imagine you're going to die tomorrow. What is that going to do? What does that do to your mind? What happens, if you think about it, what happens if you're going to die tomorrow is that you don't get angry with people anymore. Because it's like you're starting to disconnect from the world, right? You no longer have that same connection to the people, to the world around you. Because you know you're going to pass away. You know you cannot have that connection anymore. So it's like your mind is forced to disconnect. And when you disconnect, what happens is that because the attachments go away, the desires that relate to this world also start to disappear. And any anger and negativity you may have also disappears. So when you use this reflection in a nice way, you become very peaceful. It's a very beautiful reflection. The idea of death is not supposed to be frightening or bad. It's supposed to be beautiful. So if you do it in the right way, how do you feel? You feel at peace, you feel relaxed, you feel detached from the world, you feel you don't have a certain involvement with the world. And that is when you know that this reflection on death is actually working in the right way. So you think to yourself, one day it's going to be tomorrow. One day, tomorrow I'm going to die. Now that day could be today. If I'm not ready today, I'm not going to be ready when it actually is tomorrow. So this is how the contemplation of death, it kind of clears your mind of all the rubbish, of all the nonsense that we go around thinking about. Okay, let's go on to the next one here. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I must be parted and separated from everything and everyone dear and agreeable to me. Beings have desire and lust in regard to those people and things that are dear and agreeable, and excited by this lust, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the desire and lust in regard to everyone and everything dear and agreeable is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for this sake, for this benefit, that a woman or man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. So this is very similar to the death contemplation. When you die, you know that you're going to have to give everything up. This is just more specific. You're focusing directly on those things that you're going to be separated from. So when you remember this, then you don't hold on so tightly. You don't hold on so tightly to the people in your life. You don't hold on so tightly to your possessions. And then when you do that again, you feel more peaceful. You feel more at ease. Okay, so let's go to the last one. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resource. I will be the heir of whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. People engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, such misconduct is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am the owner of my karma, the heir of my karma. I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. This is just to remind you that you are creating your own future, right? Not only your future, but also your present, but particularly the future. It's up to you to create that future in the right way. So if you want a good future, then you have to do the right thing to create that good future. Okay, I don't think I will say anything more about that. Maybe we can just move on to the other sutta. Does anybody have any questions about this one before we move on? Everybody happy? Yeah? Okay. So let's go back to the gradual framing that we were working on before. So this has been like a detour from the gradual training, and now we can come back to the gradual training again. So what we were looking at before in the gradual training was this idea of sense restraint, how to avoid negative emotions to arise due to the impressions we get through the senses. So all of the things that we have looked at in the meantime, they have been like using wisdom, how to use wisdom to have clarity of mind, to understand how we should react in these kind of circumstances. So this idea of all this way of thinking is that as you build up this way of thinking, as you think in this way very often, you're able in daily life, you're able to see that, okay, I'm about to get angry with somebody, I'm about to get desire for something which is no good. And because of all the wisdom, all the reflection you have done in the meantime, you're able to stop that before it actually arises. But it only works if it's real. It has to be real. It can't just be a theory. You know, the theory that, you know, okay, when somebody has a good quality, it's like a theory in the mind. It actually has to be real. You really have to understand that there is a danger involved with anger. And you have to understand that almost from personal experience, seeing it inside yourself. And when you see that, and when you understand the idea of separating out the qualities of people, seeing the good and seeing the bad, when you actually see this experientially, directly, then it becomes very meaningful for yourself. Often the problem with the Dhamma is that it often becomes too theoretical. But the whole purpose of the Dhamma, the whole purpose of Buddhism, is that it is a very practical thing. It's something which applies directly and immediately to each one of us. Okay, so let us move on to the next one in this gradual training. And this is here called full awareness. I'll talk about this in a second, what it actually means. But this is how it reads here.
Can you tell where exactly we are?
Where we are? Okay. You know which sutta we are?
Which one?
It's the one, the discourse on the simile of the elephant footprint.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And have you got the paragraph numbers there?
Yeah.
So paragraph 16, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay. So this is how it goes. He becomes one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning. Who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs. Who acts in full awareness when wearing his robe and carrying his outer robe and bowl. Who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. Who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating. Who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. Okay, the first thing here is that it's important to get the translation right. So the word in Pali here behind full awareness is called sampajanya, is the word in Pali here. And this word sampajanya is related to the Pali word panya. Panya in Pali is the word for wisdom. So what this is really about, it's about the kind of, it's a wisdom aspect to this. So calling it full awareness is actually quite misleading. What it means more like is right understanding about these things. So the translation that you see now these days is more common. This is quite an old translation. A more modern translation is actually clear comprehension. So what this is really about is about having a sense of understanding and a sense of clarity about all of these things. So what are these things? What is the common denominator? What is it that brings? What are all these actions? Why precisely this list of actions? And if you look at this list, you will see that this is a list basically of all the things that we do in daily life, all the things that are outside of, like, if you like, meditation practice. This refers to how we should act in all the things in life which are not part of the meditation practice. So the idea here is that if you are wise about how you live your ordinary life, then that will not affect your meditation practice in a bad way, but actually will support your meditation practice. This is certainly the case for monastic life. If you are a monk and nun, this is very important. But it also obviously works as well for someone who is not a monastic. Yeah. So the idea of clear comprehension is that you understand why you are doing something, right? You understand the purpose of the act. So, for example, if you are a monk here and you are going on alms round, you're going to get your food in the village on alms round, then you know that, okay, now I have to do this because I'm going for alms round. I'm not going into the village to, you know, look around to see all the nice entertainment, or to, you know, if you are a monk, to look at the women or whatever. This is not the purpose, right? If you do that, you're going to create problems for yourself. The purpose for going into the town is only for this purpose, to receive alms. So you are clear about the purpose why you're doing something here. And this is, in a sense, whenever you do something in life, if you are, you know, very serious about the spiritual life, about developing your mind, you always can always ask this question: what is the purpose of what I'm doing? Is it a purpose? Is it a purpose that is going to support my spiritual life, or is it a purpose? Is it something which is going to hinder my spiritual life? So this is what clear comprehension means. Clear comprehension is you understand the purpose of the things you are doing, and you choose a suitable purpose, a purpose which helps you and aids you in your spiritual practice. Then there is another aspect of clear comprehension, is sometimes called the aspect of suitability. So, for example, if you become a monk, you have to decide maybe what monastery you should live in, who should be your teacher. So you find a monastery. The purpose is to become a monk, but the suitability, some monasteries might be more suitable than others. Or you may say that meditation serves the purpose of building up the spiritual life, but certain meditation might be more suitable for your temperament than other meditations. So you do, basically, you do what works, right? What is best? What has the best effect? There's two factors: purpose and suitability. Yeah. So what this means then, as it says here, you have clear comprehension when looking ahead or looking away. In other words, you look to a place for the right reason. You don't look to a place what might increase your defilements. So you look in the right way. Yeah. Then you have this idea of wearing your bowl and robe, the idea of eating, drinking, consuming and tasting. You eat to support your monastic life, right? You don't eat too much so that you become too drowsy. You don't eat too little so you become hungry. You eat just the right amount to support your spiritual practice. When you wear your monastic robe, or even as a layperson, when you wear your clothes, you don't wear this because it is a fancy robe. You like kind of special, you know, special cloth perhaps and all these kind of things. Monastic robe, the purpose of the monastic robe is just to keep you warm when it's cold, and just kind of to keep you clad in something. It's surprising sometimes, even in monastic life, people can be very keen on what kind of robes they're wearing and all this kind of stuff. It's surprising, but actually it can very easily happen because it is just part of, you know, human defilements basically. So you remember the purpose of these things and you have clear comprehension about it. Then you have, towards the very end there, you have the full comprehension or clear comprehension about, it says here, falling asleep, which actually is not quite right. It's actually sleeping. Clear comprehension about sleeping is actually the correct translation. Waking up is also not quite correct. It actually means clear comprehension about being awake. Yeah. And then talking and keeping silent. And the idea here is not that you... And this is the problem with the translation full awareness. If it is full awareness, then it doesn't make any sense to have full awareness while sleeping, certainly while sleeping. Yeah. The point is not about that. The point is that you have clear comprehension about these things. You understand how much sleep you need. You sleep the right amount, not too much, not too little. You talk the right amount. You talk when it's required, and when it's not required, you don't talk, you remain silent. So it's like having a clear understanding about the purpose of these things and then doing it to the right quantity. So that is in short what clear comprehension is about. And we can see how all of these things, how everything here is supportive of your spiritual practice. So I want to relate this to the Noble Eightfold Path. And remember what I said, I think on the first day or the second day or whatever, I can't remember now, yesterday or the day before, I was saying how each the gradual training here, how it actually matches with the Noble Eightfold Path, right? The gradual training begins with the Buddha arising in the world, which is like right view. Then you have the going forth or wishing to practice the Dhamma, which is the right intention. Then you have the moralities, speech, body, and livelihood. And then comes after that, the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is right effort. So these things we're looking at now comes under right effort. Okay, so and one other thing I should probably say as well, when you read this, it feels like it relates to monks, right? I mean, the whole thing about carrying the ball and all these kind of things, or to nuns perhaps. But this can also relate to lay people. Even though it is phrased in monastic terms, it still has a relevance to lay Buddhists as well. And all it really does, it just tells you that, you know, how you spend your time, how you spend your life, it actually affects you. And because it affects you, you are wise about what you do in your life, how you spend your time, what friends you have, etc., etc. Okay, so this is then right effort, and then now we are slowly moving over to right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is what is coming next here. So this is how it goes. This is what it says here. So possessing this aggregate of noble virtue and this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. It's nice, isn't it, how it's called, everything is called noble? Isn't that it's quite beautiful here. And one reason why it's called noble is because it makes you noble if you practice in this way. And the interesting thing here is that only at this point it says here that you resort to a secluded resting place. So resorting to a secluded resting place means that you find yourself a place which is secluded, apart from other people, apart from society. And this, of course, is an indication that this is where meditation begins. This is like real meditation, right? This is where your meditation actually really becomes strong and actually really works. And that's why it says you're supposed to go to a secluded place. In other words, it's supposed to be by yourself. Unless you are very firm, unless you are very established, unless your mind is very strong. Sometimes going to be by yourself can be very difficult, right? You have to be very strong inside of yourself to be able to go, to stay by yourself. And it's not just about being able to stay by yourself, it's actually being able to enjoy staying by yourself. So this is where meditation begins. So let's have a look at the next phrase here. On returning from his arms round after his meal, he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and establishes mindfulness before him. Now this phrase here is quite an important phrase. And when you see this phrase, you know, I know straight away, because I know I've read this sutta so many times, that this is exactly the same phrase you find at the beginning of the discourse on mindfulness of breathing. And it's also similar to some of the things you find when the Satipatthana, the right mindfulness, is talked about in the suttas. So you know that when you see, we know straight away that what we're talking about now is meditation practice. And what, of course, is very important here is this whole idea that all of these other things, they have to, ideally, you have done all of these other things before you actually start your meditation practice. And the reason for that is because if you do all these other things, then when you come to meditation, you have a natural mindfulness. Your mindfulness is, you are in the present moment, you have a sense of clarity about the present moment, and because you have that natural mindfulness there, meditation is quite easy, quite straightforward. So the most important part of meditation practice is not so much what you do in the meditation itself. The most important part is actually all the other stuff that you do outside of meditation. And that's why I have taken so much time to focus on all these other things, because this is actually where you make meditation possible. Okay, so let's have a quick look at what he says here. So it says, folding his legs crosswise, right? Which basically means sitting cross-legged. So sometimes when people see that, they say the only way you can meditate is by sitting with your legs cross-legged. But I don't think that's actually what it means. I think what this means is basically that at the time of the Buddha, people were used to sitting on the ground. This was like a natural posture for them. And because it was a natural posture for them, that was actually what was comfortable for people in those days. So if you are comfortable sitting cross-legged, that's great. But the main purpose here is actually being comfortable, being at ease, being relaxed. That is the main purpose behind this. It has also here, it says that you sit down. So what this means that if you're going to do real meditation practice, the real deep meditation, it happens while you sit. That's what it basically what it means. And it says that you set your body erect. Now, the reason for that, of course, that if your body is straight, there's usually more clarity in the mind, right? But you can't really force that clarity. So you have to be careful. You have to know that, again, the right time for setting the body erect. If you do it too early on, if you try to be straight away, you will feel tense. You will feel it won't be natural. But if it is the right time, if mindfulness is good, then that straightness of the body will be very natural and easy for you. So what this means is that when you start meditation, for example, if you want to start off by leaning against the back of the chair or leaning against the wall, that's perfectly okay. And then as your mindfulness improves, there comes a point when sitting straight becomes natural. Even someone like my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, who is a very, very skilled meditator, he's one of those very, very, gets very profound meditation practice. He often says that when he starts off his meditation, maybe because he's tired, he's been working hard, had a long day, very often he starts by leaning back against the wall. So basically, you have to remember, you have to be wise about these things. This is what it comes down to. Be wise. See what you need, what works. This is what is important. Don't force yourself into things that are unnatural, that are uncomfortable. There's no magic in having a particular posture. The magic is in allowing the body to disappear because it's no longer important. And then the last thing it says here, it says that you establish mindfulness before you. And the way you do that is, first of all, the most important way of establishing mindfulness is all the things we have talked about before. This is how mindfulness becomes established when you sit down to meditate. So it is a long course, right? Establishing a mindfulness is not something you can do just by sitting down. It's something that happens gradually, over a long period of time. And what you can do when you go to meditate, or you go on a meditation retreat or whatever, is that then you have to kind of rely on all the work that you have done throughout the months, throughout the years, to help you with that mindfulness. So often it's just a matter of waiting, right? You wait till your mind calms down, you wait for your mind to regain its energy, and then you allow all the effort you put in the past to kind of build up inside of you and come to the fore. Okay, so that is kind of the introduction. So now what we're talking about now is meditation practice. So ideally what we should be looking at now is something like the Anapanasati Sutta, which is maybe the most famous sutta about mindfulness of breathing. And it's very useful to know that this is about meditation practice, because it's not so clear from the text here that this is what it means. So this is what it says. It says here, abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free of covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware, or mindful and clearly comprehending. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. You can probably recognize this as the five hindrances, the five nivaranas. And in one way it's surprising, right? Because we have been already purifying, first through conduct and speech, then through the sense restraint. And although we have been purifying all this time, and suddenly now he talks about the five hindrances. So why is that? And the reason is because at this point you are getting very close. You started the meditation practice. The hindrances, the defilements of the mind are already very low, but there still is a little bit of defilements left. So what this means, when we talk about the five hindrances, what we are referring to is a very weak aspect of the five, of the defilements. And it is only this very weak aspect of the hindrances that you can purify through meditation practice. And this is why you see here, you see that we are talking about two things at the same time. We're talking about meditation practice, which is very clear from the first sentence. You sit down, put your legs cross-legged, etc. It's about meditation. And at the same time, it's also about abandoning the hindrances. So this is where these things come together. But this abandoning of defilements through meditation, it only works if the defilements are already very, very weak. So it's quite, you know, imagine that you meditate. Now, if your defilements are already quite weak, what it means is that if you then watch the breath, it's quite easy to watch the breath. It's the defilements, it's the desires, the problems in the mind. This is what takes the mind away from the breath. So the defilements are very weak. It is quite easy and natural to focus on the breath. And because you are focusing on the breath, it means you're not allowing the mind to go to certain objects that you desire. You're not allowing the mind to go to objects you don't like that might create anger. So because you're not allowing your mind to go to these things, it means that all of these desires and angers, gradually they diminish and become less and less. So by focusing on the breath, it's like you're taking away the fuel for the defilements. And what we really should be doing now, we should really have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta, because the Anapanasati Sutta shows you what happens when you're watching the breath, how gradually, stage by stage, you become more and more peaceful, more and more aware, more and more calm. But there's no time for that, unfortunately, so we're just going to have to continue with this. So you use the Anapanasati, you use the Satipatthana practice, whatever it is, to then gradually overcome the defilements until the mind is completely pure. So remember when we're talking about the first day, we're talking about the purification of the mind, right? How purification happens stage by stage. So this is now. Now you're reaching the culmination point. You've been purifying, getting more and more pure. And now finally, for the first time, you find that full sense of purity inside. This is where the gold is starting to come out, right? You're seeing the gold for the first time. You're seeing something beautiful, something shining, something powerful. Now, the next thing now, we have gone through the right mindfulness, which is Satipatthana, just have been looking at now. And one nice way of translating right mindfulness is simply as a meditation practice. This is kind of the meditation that leads up to the deep stages of samadhi. So again, remember, we're talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. So after mindfulness, then comes right samadhi, samma samadhi, which is the next thing on this gradual training here. So this is what happens then, and it says, as it says here, having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This Brahmin is called a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Okay, so you can see here that this, now we're talking about the real samadhi, right? The real deep states of meditation and all of this work that you have to do to get here. But of course it's worth it, right? If you discover something beautiful, something profound, and not only do you discover something very beautiful, but the whole path is very beautiful. As you practice this path, every stage of the way, you feel more light, you feel more happy, you feel more at ease, you feel more independent, you feel more relaxed. Everything comes with this path. Every stage is beautiful, but now you get into things which are really incredibly powerful and incredibly beautiful. And just to have a quick look at how this jhana is explained, the first thing it says here that the hindrances are imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom. So what that means is that the only way, if you want to be wise, the only way is that you have to abandon these hindrances. And this is one reason why what we're seeing now, the samma samadhi, these jhanas, why they are so important. they are so important, because once you get to these states, then the hindrances, you are far away from the hindrances, and that's when wisdom becomes possible. Okay, so what then is this jhana? The first thing it says here, it says, quite secluded from sensual pleasures. Now, I think a better translation of that is secluded from the five senses. The Pali word behind this is the word kama, and the word kama has two different meanings. It can either mean the desire regarding the five senses, and that is how it is used in the singular, but in the plural, it actually refers to the five senses themselves. And here we find the word used in the plural, so I think the right translation here is actually secluded from the five senses. So this is one of the markers of a deep state of samadhi. One of the markers, one of the ways that you know that this is happening, is that the whole world that relates to the five senses disappears. You're going completely inside the mind. You will notice that in meditation practice, you will notice how as you meditate, when you become more peaceful, it's as if the world moves away, right? You're going into yourself. It's as if the world becomes further away. And you notice how beautiful that is, how peaceful that is. And that process of the world kind of disappearing, of the world fading away, that process culminates in the point when the world disappears completely. So that is one of the ways you can know that you have achieved a very deep state of samadhi. Then you have the second one here, secluded from unwholesome states. Now, unwholesome states here basically refers back to the five hindrances we saw before. So when the mind is in jhana, it is a perfectly pure state of mind. Then you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought. Now, applied and sustained thought here means like a tiny movement of the mind. It's like the mind is still moving a little bit. It's not perfectly steady. And it has rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. In other words, the jhana state is basically a state of pure happiness. And that's what is meant by this last phrase here. And then comes a very powerful statement. It says, this Brahmana is called the footprint of the Tathagatas. In other words, a footprint of the Buddha. Something scraped by the Buddha. Something marked by the Buddha. Remember how the sutta started off. The sutta started off by, if you're going to look for an elephant in the forest, you see a big footprint, right? And then you see something scraped on the tree. And on the basis of that, you think, maybe this is a big elephant. You're not 100% sure yet, but you're seeing the marks of a big elephant. It is possible that this is a big elephant. And this is the power of these states. When you come to these states, they are so profound that when you come to a deep state of samadhi, and you know that you are, it's almost like you are in the presence of the Buddha. You cannot yet be 100% sure, but you know that this jhana, this is a mark of the Buddha. If the Buddha was there, this is the kind of thing the Buddha would be doing. It's a very powerful simile. It's very kind of very strong. And one of the things that you find in the suttas, in the word of the Buddha, you always find this. You always find the jhanas, and then you find the stages of awakening, the stages of deep understanding and realization. These are always together. It's like they form one unit, because these are like the profoundest aspects of the Buddha's teaching. So this one of the interesting things here as well, because now we are at the stage of samasamadhi, of deep meditation. And one of the interesting things about the Buddha's teaching is that the Eightfold Path actually stops at that particular point. And the reason why it stops there is because now you have done the practice, and the results of doing that practice is awakening, is understanding. That is a natural result of this practice. So if you start off with a right view, remember right view at the beginning, the Buddha arising in the world. If you start off with that, and you practice this whole thing, and you get to the deep samadhi, and the result of that is awakening. There's no more time to actually read the rest of the sutta, but the rest of the sutta, then, first of all, it goes through the other jhanas. You have the first jhana, then you have the second, third, and fourth jhana. And after that, then comes the awakening experience itself. Then, when you reach the awakening, that is when you know that now, with the jhanas, you can see the footprint, but you haven't actually seen the Buddha yet, right? But when you get to the awakening experience, that's when you're like seeing the elephant sitting at the foot of a tree. It's like you see the Buddha for the first time. So there you are. That is the gradual training. very nice, very profound, very beautiful. In my opinion, I love this kind of discourse. And it has all so much to it. There's so much information in there. You know, you can just, you could use that discourse, and you could talk about that discourse for 2 or 3 weeks if you wanted to, by taking in suttas from elsewhere and bringing it in. Because this is really the full power of practice found in one individual sutta. So I just want to say just a couple of minutes at the very end, just a few last words, just to maybe summarize things a little bit. So hopefully you now have some idea of what the Buddhist path is about. Not only some idea, but you have hopefully quite a bit of information. So now it's just a matter of applying this and actually doing these things. And one of the most important things in applying yourself is to remember to inspire yourself on the Buddhist path. Without that inspiration, without the reminder, and you need the reminder quite regularly, without that, it's very hard to sustain the practice. So get a book which you can read, like the suttas, for example, the book I was recommending the other day, In the Words of the Buddha. Get something like that. Listen to a talk at a regular interval when you need inspiration. And this way, by getting kind of input at a regular intervals, you will be able to sustain yourself, inspire yourself, and keep the practice going. And then the way that you know that you're making progress, the way you know that, is that every year, if you are keen on meditation practice, try to do a meditation retreat every year. Then you look at your mind from year to year. You see what happens. What was it like last year? What is it this year? And if you can see that from year to year, you can see that something is happening inside of you. Your mind is becoming more clear. Your mind is becoming more peaceful. You feel more gentle, more soft, more kind-hearted inside. You have more compassion. You have more peace. If you see this is happening, and at the same time you can see all the negative things, the irritations, the desires, the confusion, all that is going down. If you see this changing like this from year to year, you know you're doing the right thing here. But if you're not making progress, if you're feeling more angry, more confused, etc., etc., sometimes this happens, right? Sometimes it seems to go in the wrong way here. And that also is just a sign. Then you need to ask yourself, why is this? Why am I not making progress? And by looking at that, then you have to change. You have to reflect. This is such an important part of the Buddhist practice. You actually do reflect on what you're doing. Is it working? Is it not working? And then guide yourself based on that. And when you do this, it becomes very powerful and very beautiful, because then you feel like you have a life becomes very purposeful, right? There's a very powerful meaning to life there, because you're doing something which actually is changing you. You actually feel that you're doing something really worthwhile in life. And this is one of the powerful things about this. It gives you a very clear sense of direction, a very clear sense of purpose. Okay, so that's all I want to say. Yes, sir.
I have one question about sutta.
Okay, yeah.
Some of the teachers that have visited us here have directly said that they don't practice jhana meditation.
So I
wonder if there can be different interpretations, or
Well, this is the nice thing about reading the sutta, because if you read the sutta, you can find out for yourself whether you should practice jhana or not. And if you read the sutta, you know, every other sutta basically has a jhana in it. So this is a great thing about going back to the word of the Buddha. You can actually know for yourself. You don't have to rely on this teacher or that teacher. You can find out for yourself. So I would recommend that. It sets you more free in a sense, which is a good thing about it. But I think one of the important things about these jhanas and things is not to think too much about it, because sometimes you get too much desire. I want to have jhana. But remember, jhanas are very, very profound things. There's a large part of the Buddhist path before the jhanas. And that part is also very beautiful. Lots of wonderful experiences to be had, lots of peace, lots of happiness, lots of beauty. But when you get to jhana, it's like you're almost enlightened already, right? This is very, very profound. And I think this is one of the main reasons why many people don't talk about it. Because it's very rare to find anybody who actually has these kind of experiences. So just enjoy the path. And then let the jhanas take care of themselves. Just a second, Kasper. I think Rudit, you want to say anything?
No.
You're okay? Okay. Kasper, yeah.
Secluded from sensual pleasures, who's secluded from the five senses. Product is still feeling pleasure with the body.
I understand the question. Okay, the thing here, this is the way this Pali... This is actually quite hard, because this is about translating the Pali in the right way. So this gets quite complicated. But experiencing pleasure with the body here, this is Kayena Sukang Patisang Vedeti in Pali here. So what it means, Patisangvedeta means to experience, sukha is happiness, and kayena quite literally means with the body. But you have to, the problem here is that the word body is used in many different ways in the Pali here. And I will give you some examples. For example, it says in the suttas, it says that you achieve the immaterial attainments, you touch the immaterial attainments with the body here. It says in the sutta that you touch or you achieve the deathless, the amatang, with the body. Yeah. And in those cases, it's very clear that the body does not refer to the physical body. Yeah. So the word body needs to be interpreted according to the context. It's the same thing in English as well. In English, the word body can have many different meanings. For example, in English, you can talk about a body of evidence. So body in English, just like in Pali, can just mean a group, an accumulation, a heap of something here. In fact, the root meaning of the word body actually is just that. It means heap. It means a conglomeration here. So the idiomatic meaning of the word body in this kind of context, it means direct experience here. So just like you touch something with the body, if you experience something directly with the mind, it's called with the body because it is an immediate experience here. So the meaning, as I understand it, in the third jhana, when it says kayena sukkam patisang vedi, the meaning of that is just that it's the first time ever that you experience pure happiness. In the second jhana, there's still piti there, there's still rapture. It's only when you get to the third jhana that happiness stands completely by itself. So it is an immediate and direct experience of happiness. That's why it's called kayena sukkam patisang vedeti. But the reason why people like Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as with the body is basically because he wants to be consistent in his translation. If you look at other suttas, the suttas often make a distinction between the namakaya and the rupakaya. Rupakaya is physical body, whereas namakaya is mental body. And in this particular case, if you look at the commentary defines this as the body, meaning the namakaya, the mental body.
And in the fourth jhana's description, there is a description, abandoning of pleasure and with the abandoning of pleasure and pain.
Yeah.
His question is, who is abandoning pleasure and pain?
Okay, it's a natural process, right? I think it says here, dukkha sukha pahana, I think it means from the abandoning of pleasure and pain, or due to, because of the abandoning of pleasure and pain, that's quite literally what happens. So just because of that, then you go into the fourth jhana. So it shows you the cause. It shows you the cause of the fourth jhana. It happens because of this abandoning. So it's more like a process, right? It happens as a natural process. So before you enter jhana, you have your mind inclines in a certain direction. It inclines towards a very deep state of peace. And because the mind inclines towards that, then when you enter the jhana, it goes so deeply that it goes straight to the fourth jhana, for example. Okay, so, yeah, that was a bit technical towards the end there, but important questions, because these are questions that people have who study the suttas, so these are important issues. Let's have a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back for the meditation in 5 minutes.